wife Kathy, who's sitting over here today, and we were talking last night or yesterday, I think afternoon, and she was quoting David Benner, who's a smart guy on Christian transformation, and he was saying that the transformation begins when we see how God sees us. And I hope that you'll hear in the words today how God sees you. I think that was in the poem there, you know, at the end, to be seen. And that's my goal today, because I think if that happens, some really good things are going to happen for you. So we were driving along, and we were listening to a podcast, I don't know, about 3 weeks ago, something like that. It's a podcast on the Renovare. It was Mimi Dixon was being interviewed. Dixon knows something about the dynamics of spiritual growth. She studied a lot about suffering and joy and how all those things go into this thing called transformation. She's pastored a church for over 30 years. She's an expert on the life of Julian of Norwich, if you know something about Julian of Norwich, someone who suffered in the Middle Ages. And Dixon is a spiritual director. And she explained in that podcast how suffering, when experienced correctly, can be redemptive. And it's really about knowing and having an assurance that in our suffering, things are going to end not okay, but they're going to end very well. They're going to end very well. And she said this thing kind of funny. She said, you know, your life is, I'm going to paraphrase it, but she said, you know, your life is like a murder mystery. I mean, you open up the book, and the body's right there in the first chapter, and it's your body. We know you're going to die. And if you're like me, you probably skip to the back to see at the end and find out how it happened. And then in between, we're just going to see how we lived and how we died. And we know this at the very beginning. And what's very important here is that in this murder mystery, how you will end very well. And that can impact how you live all your days in between. Remember we started this series 7-8 weeks ago? We opened the study of Abraham's life with this remarkable promise from Jehovah to Abraham. But it led, the first sentence was before he gave him the promise, is a challenge. God lays this challenge out for Abraham, for Abram. And it's, you can tell I've been listening to the Bama podcast, sorry, Abram. And I'm just going to read it. So it says, this comes, if we're not going to have it on the screen, but this is from Genesis 12, the first two verses. The Lord has said to Abram, go from your country, your people and your father's household to the land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. So the first part of that is God telling him, I want you to go. I want you to travel. I don't want you to let the grass grow underneath your feet. Don't want you to be like other people. I want you to be rough, and I want you to be holy. I don't want you to put roots down too deep. And in this time, to be told to do that, it wasn't like loading the family up and moving to Central Florida. I mean, it was scary. It was the Middle East. It's a desert. It's hundreds, thousands of years ago. It's not a place of great abundance. It takes real wisdom and skill to live. You're going to leave your family, and you're going to take your extended family, which wasn't small, and your herds and all those things. It's really a dangerous challenge. But he's saying, if you'll do this, Abram, then you're going to come into a land, and there you're going to have this sort of great abundance. I'm going to make you into a great nation. So that's how we started. We've gone through 7 successive weeks, and we've seen that Abram is the sort of guy who, when he's in a pinch, when things haven't gone well, he gets in a scuff, gets scuffed up, gets knocked down, he's the sort of person that in that scuffing, in that bumping, he always comes back to relying on God. He's the sort of person in whom suffering breeds reliance instead of defiance. Those are the two alternatives, right? In life, when difficulty hits, we can become reliant or we can become defiant. And the same is true of abundance. Abundance has the same effect. So we've seen that he's the sort of guy that does things imperfectly, but he's always learning, he's always dusting himself off, and he's always going forward, each time with greater peace. And we're going to see today in these words that Wes started us off with that that he's gonna die well. So at the first part of this passage that Wes read for us, there's sort of a bridge. Genesis is laid out, so right before this, there was kind of a jump in the action to Isaac. But back before this, we saw the text that talked about how Sarah, Abram's first wife, had passed away, had died. And then there's this sort of bridge in this opening verses of this chapter that ties some things together for us that tell us that after Sarah died, Abraham remarried, and that Sarah had six sons, and we know from where these people group went after this that their progeny became the tribes of people that occupied the land to the south and to the east of Canaan, roughly Arabia, if you're kind of figuring in your head where that's at. I think it's worth noting that, I can't say these names correctly, but Keterah, I'm going to say Keterah, her name likely means incense, and in ancient times, how you named your child was sort of a clue as to how their life was going to wind, and so it's sort of nice for me to just think that here in Abraham's life, he finds this wife, probably a concubine before, and she has her character of her as this essence of incense. So there's this sort of bridge in there that tells us that, he wasn't, you know, he went forward in his life even after losing Sarah. So then we move into the action about Abraham dying, and there's this phrase I like that says that Abraham died at a good old age, and his life was full of years. My mother passed away earlier this year, and we just had like always happens at all these sorts of things in my family, there's always the benefit. There's the funeral, right? And then there's the reason we all really come, which is the event that happens afterwards where we all get together and we catch up, right, and we talk. And when we gather together, it's incredibly meaningful to reminisce and bask in the stories and catch up and remember what that person's life meant. In fact, sometimes I think in telling those stories, death makes clear what life has kept hidden about a person. Death makes clear what was previously hidden about a person. And that is, like in Keterah, it's this sort of essence. So as we sat and we gathered together and we thought about my mom's life, it became clear that what my mother's life was about, this essence of my mother, was kindness. And we marveled at all the ways her grandchildren and her children and nieces and nephews all experienced her as kindness. And I think this is important because if we can get to understand the essence of the people that are before us, our ancestors, we can manifest as their heirs that sort of character in our own lives because we have their example. So I wonder if, as Abraham died at this good old age and his life was full of years, if his sons Isaac and Ishmael didn't swap stories, like every family swaps stories, right? And I wonder what kind of conversations they had about the events of their lives. I wonder if they talked with each other about what a blessing it must have been to be a son. I wonder if they told the story about, you know, that they had heard the mother in the case of Isaac, recount the story of how the family how Sarah and Abraham had traveled into Egypt during the famine. These stories got forward some way, and I'm just suggesting that the way they got forward is they started as family lore. I don't know that, but that's what I'm suggesting. Perhaps Isaac recounted through his own lens, in his own words, the terrible trial of being led to become a sacrifice, and then the immense joy of finding that God would provide a sacrifice and would spare his life. Or maybe Ishmael talked about what it was like to also have been abandoned and put out in the desert with his mother when he was 17, rejected by Abraham, and how they ran out of water and how they took refuge underneath a bush and waited to die and how God had spared him. Maybe they recounted the family story about how Sarai had laughed at God's promise. Perhaps they honored their family by praising how he had lived as an immensely kind neighbor, incredibly hospitable person, who took his flocks everywhere, and in every land he lived was blessed by the people around him. I imagine that all who knew Abraham marveled at the fullness of his life, more than the size of his herds, right? We all know, it's no surprise, there are no luggage racks on hearses. But that's how we live, right? We'll take a look at not just stuff, but take a look at our calendars, take a look at those things that we used to call checkbooks, our banking accounts. And you have to wonder if there's not a disconnection between those things and the things that will make our lives marvelous. And I'm suggesting then for you that maybe this is a day to begin to think about what stories will be told about you. How will people say that your life was so full? Then what I'm suggesting here is that if you want to die well, you need to die now. If you want to die well, you need to die now. All the small deaths make you ready for the great death, which is of great grace as well. And if we haven't died enough along the way, maybe the death isn't so great. So if you want fullness of your stories, don't focus on the size of your herds. Focus on what's really happening in your life. Okay. It says also that he was gathered to his people. And so that seemed like, that phrase jumped out to me. I was like, what does that mean? And so I did what you would do. I texted the three most important people in the world that would know this, Nathan, Mike, and Wes. And it turns out there's no agreement as to what this means. No, this is pretty different language here, and it can mean a lot of different things. Some scholars think that it could be a reference to the tradition of collecting bones of the dead and placing them collectively into an ossuary of the family. Makes perfect sense. We know that bones were really important to folks in this time, and there was actually sort of two burials. Their books were buried, and then they would go back, and they would collect the bones, and they would rebury the bones. So that's possible. That makes kind of perfect sense. Some folks think this means that Abraham was comforted as he joined the family of his loved ones after his death. And I know that to be true in the case of my own mother, that in her last week that she began to talk more and more about her sisters, and she started to see them, and she became very ready for her death as she considered and was convinced, you know, that she would rejoin her family soon. And that was really comforting. So that's a possibility, right? And then there could also be this phrase could really be validation of the promise in Genesis 15 earlier, because this is the first time this promise showed up. And it's going to show up here up behind me. And I'm just going to read verse 15. The promise says, "You, however, will go down to you'll go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age." So this sticks out to me. And the reason it does is because it happened. So here's this statement way back here that one day this will happen, and here it is happening way up here. And that, a lot of things I think are promises in life don't come around. So I pay attention when they do. This one came true. Similar like when Jesus said, you know, "I go to prepare a place for you." That was a promise. That's going to happen. And it's banked on all the way back, I think, to this promise right here. So this promise matters because it actually happened. It's not an empty promise. And as we've learned over the last 8 or so weeks, this is all wrapped up in covenant, specifically this Abrahamic covenant. And for those who trust the same God, they become co-heirs. So we are co-heirs in this same promise. You, insert your name, will go to your ancestors in peace, and you will be buried at a good old age. Okay. Genesis 25, 9 through 10a really jumped out at me. His sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in a cave of Machpelah near Mamre in the field of Ephron, son of Zorar, the Hittite, the field Abraham had bought from the Hittites. I think what comes up here for me is, you know, Abraham didn't really ever receive the fullness of the promise. He was a sojourner. He traveled to the land, but he never truly possessed it. In fact, the only land he owned at the end is this land that he's buried in. So there's this way in which the promise didn't happen in his lifetime. And this promise about being your progeny, being like the stars of the sky and the sand on the beach, that didn't come true entirely either. Although progeny was produced and children came, it only happened partially. He didn't become the father of nations in his lifetime, though in time he would be considered the father of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, which is amazing. So there's this sort of suffering that we have in life. I think it's some of the most difficult when we receive some sort of a promise and then we're just sort of simply living our lives and waiting for something to actually happen. We're really just waiting on a miracle, right? And why is that necessary, though? Because why is that necessary? So I'm going to skip way forward. You go all the way to the book of Hebrews in the Christian New Testament, in the New Testament. In chapter 11, whoever the writer of Hebrews there, talking about Abraham and others like him, says, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had the opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. There's a lot in there. In this verse of Hebrews, these people are waiting for a country that is not their own. They have no interest in going back to their old lives, right? This is a great description of Abraham and of us, I think. The question I have is, where's God in this? Where's God when this sort of thing is happening in life, and we're waiting, and nothing is happening, nothing seems to be coming to us, all the things we're desiring? Well, my story, the way I operate, is I assume that God has abandoned me. I mistake silence for abandonment. And I think a lot of other people do too. Maybe you're one of those people. But is God so far in this text? We'd say, well, no, he's not. God is with us, right? God is preparing a heavenly dwelling for those who wait, and actually not even a dwelling, an entire city. There's a lot there to say, but suffice to say also that in the time that this story of this life of Abraham happened, that in the marriage, that this idea of going and building a dwelling is referring to a tradition where the betrothed, when you were betrothed, the husband would take a year to build a home for he and his new bride. And he would do so, it sounds terrible, under the supervision of the bride's father. So it had to be good, it had to be right. I can only imagine. That would be great for me. So what this is telling us is that God is doing that for you right in the middle of your struggle. You might not be able to see it, but that's really what's happening. He knows how this will all end, and that's to say that it will end beyond your wildest dreams, but you won't see it until the end. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. I also just imagine that the first part of that line where it says he's not ashamed to be called their God. Think of how much time in our lives and how much energy is preoccupied with this experience of shame. Love is the most powerful thing in the universe, but shame runs a close second, right? And if we're the little judge on our shoulders that's nibbling our ears in the morning when we rise, is judging us and making us feel ashamed, and also telling us that other people see it. But here is this antidote for this, and saying, no, you have this promise, even in the middle of your struggle, you're not crazy. God is beaming. He's beaming as he looks at you. He's so proud of you. He's so proud of you. So proud of you. And as I said earlier, as Kathy pointed out to me, transformation begins when we begin to see how God sees us. And he's beaming at us. Genesis 25:10, the end. There Abraham was buried with his wife Sarah. So, what is that about? For me, this is if you're married, this to me feels like this could be a real promise and a real comfort. Because who in their marriage at some point in time doesn't wonder if the thing is going to end? Maybe you have that marriage, but I think in most marriages, at some point, you die in the marriage, sometimes many times, and you wonder if you're going to get through, and you wonder how. But I think if we just imagine that the reality is the person who was crazy enough to say, I do, when they married me, and then at their 25th anniversary, said, I do again. That's something. That second one, especially in my experience, when Kathy said, I do at the 25th anniversary ceremony, she said that because even knowing what I was like already. And so this is the thought that our bones will lie there together or not. That's such a great imagery. Gives me courage to really live again in my marriage. Gives me courage to do the work for myself and on myself and not insist that she sweep her side of the street. How would it restore your heart to love your spouse that way again? It's awesome. Maybe it's right there in just imagining that ending. Genesis 25:11, after Abraham's death, God blessed his son Isaac, who then lived near Beer Lahai Roy. I'm just going to give Wes chops for getting all those big words out. This I want to get the practical part of the sermon here. I'm going to bring a little bit of caution here for you, a little bit of challenge. It's easy to miss it in this verse. Although the Lord blessed Abraham richly and that blessing from Abraham flowed to his children. In the children of his concubines, it flowed in gifts while he was alive. And in the blessing flowed onto Isaac in the form of the covenant. Abraham blessed his children fairly, but not equally. And that sounds hard for me to accept, but there it is. The covenant went forward with Isaac, not with Ishmael's children, and not with Keturah's sons. I think that the learning there is something a pastor we had years ago said, it's always stuck with us, which is that God won't make covenant with my Ishmaels. That creates a real defiance in me as I insist that he bless my mistakes. So I'm not talking about specifically about children here. I'm talking about the ways in which I exercise my will and not live inside the truth of his will. And although he will make that all work out in time, it's not the same as being in covenant. Having that part of my life in covenant. So, give me a second here. Suffering's going to create one of two things in us, defiance or reliance. One writer I read said that sometimes we become defiant because God has not given us what we want. Other times we become defiant because a catastrophe has befallen us, like a pandemic. Perhaps we have no children. Perhaps there's a pandemic. Perhaps the person you wish to marry married another. Perhaps a loved one died too young. We've all prayed for so many things that have never come to pass. Those things must break our hearts, but they must not capture your focus. They must not capture your focus. If our focus is not weaned from them, then one day where there was a soft heart in your chest, there'll just be a cold, hard stone. So how to avoid this kind of defiance? How to accept our mistakes and bring God's blessing to those mistakes, but not insist that God make covenant with those errors? I'm going to suggest a couple things. The first is just this mindfulness that you're going to die. Get close to that. This is hard to say to a younger crowd, but don't be afraid. The death, the small deaths, the struggles you're in, this is what death is. This is what you're being prepared for. The great movie, The Royal Tenenbaums. Anybody see The Royal Tenenbaums? Has the greatest line on this. It's the best movie of all time. Royal Tenenbaum, who's this senior kind of patriarch of the family, has been thrown out of the family because he's really such a terrible person, and he fakes that he's dying so he can get back in the family. And so after the gig is up and they realize, they finally confront him that he's not actually dying, he says to his son Richie, he says, "You know, Richie, this illness, the closeness to death, it's had a profound effect on me. I feel like a completely different person. I really do." And Richie looks at him incredulously and says, "Dad, you were never dying." And Royal says, "But I'm going to live." So if we really want to live, we have to get close to death. How can you do that? The first is to just pray your will into God's care. It's right there in the Lord's Prayer. Our Father art in heaven, right? Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Begin every day by asking God to take your will and to try, and so give you the strength to take your will and put it into his care, into his will. Pray God's will into your life, even when you don't feel it, even when you don't feel it, even when you don't feel it. And I would encourage you, if you've never done this, to sit down and take some time to really envision what that last week or a day of your last day or week of your life might be like. Really take time to imagine, to see yourself, you know, old like me, and imagine that, you know, what that's going to be like as you get older, and who will be there. Like, so imagine, how old will you be? What will that last day be like? Who will be there with you? What will they say? What stories will be retold? How will you be remembered? What will they say was the one big theme in your character? One word. Kurt was. Envision that. What will be the expression on your face when you reach home? Your true home. What will be the expression? Who will be there when you get home? If we get really in touch with that, can you see how that can impact our momentarily light afflictions in this day? Another great tool, I just say, get together with a friend and interrogate reality when you're really in a tough spot. I'm a great catastrophizer. When I find that I'm having a tough time, I imagine all sorts of things. My favorite one being that there's no God here. I'm alone. But all I have to be asked is that true? And listen. And usually I hear something like, God is closer than the door. But when I'm busy and I'm focused on my pain, I really need to look at my assumptions and interrogate those. Look at your difficulty and ask yourself, is it true? What I'm telling myself right now, is it true? So I don't have a big finish planned. It's a pretty practical sermon. I just wanted to take this wonderful story of Abraham and end it, not put a bow on it. He's a pretty imperfect person, but maybe for me the greatest gift that he's given in, to me looking at this series and some other reading we've been doing is this idea that today I can live real, I can have a really full life because my tomorrow is certain. And I just want to invite you into that same thing, that same reality. Let me pray for us while the band comes on up. So Heavenly Father, thank you for Abraham's life. Wow. Thank you that you've made us co-heirs with him. And thank you that that makes a big difference in our days to know that we're going to be at home with you one day. And until we are then, there's going to be some ups and downs, but you'll be with us through all of them. Amen.